You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Beth Dooley, here after a run-in on the construction. Finally made it over here. She has covered the food scene in the Northern Heartland for 25 years. She's a restaurant critic for Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine, writes for the taste section of the Minneapolis St. Paul Star Tribune, and appears regularly on Care 11. She is co-author with Lucia Watson of Savoring the Seasons of the Northern Heartland and teaches cooking classes at the Landscape Arboretum. She lives in Minneapolis with her husband and three sons, and she's here to talk about her new book. So please welcome Beth Dooley.
It's such an honor to be here. Thanks. And I did have a rather harrowing drive over, so. It's nice to have so many friends in the audience. Thank you very much for coming out. This book sort of brings into today a story that I began with Lucia Watson about 25 years ago. And that is what, you know, where do we live and how does the food we're eating inform us about who we are, where we've come from, and what this region is about. And actually, John Borchert, who was a well-known demographer and a professor at the University of Minnesota, coined the term Northern Heartland. And he did so to define the area as one being governed by settlement patterns, by the weather, and by what grows here. And so we took those three things into account when we began to explore this region's history, its demography, and all the ethnic influences that came into the cooking, and then how what grows here became part of that story as well. And so we looked into that, and then this book takes that story into what's going on today, which is fascinating. We see a lot of the themes that we discovered early on really coming to fruition because our culture is so grounded in a farming culture. It's one that's really community-based, it's value-oriented, it's one that's connected to land in, a much deeper way than we're seeing on the East Coast. And I can say that with some confidence because I grew up in New Jersey. And you know, here, if you scratch a Minnesotan, and you'll probably find a farmer less than a generation away. Most of us have some connection, deep connection, to the land and the food that grows there. And so I thought I'd just read a little bit from the introduction. Unlike those who live in warm, tropical climates, we are governed by the seasons. The weather in this northern heartland is dramatic. Nature shapes our physical environment as well as our emotional landscape. To live well here is to celebrate the year's changing riches, autumn's crisp air, brilliant colors, and snappy apples, winter's bluster, and those simmering, window-glazing stews. How we yearn for spring's greens and pink rhubarb, and how we delight in summer's shimmering gold. Come July, those perfect juice-splitting tomatoes reward our January patience. To eat local means to pay attention to the light, the temperature, and the land's bounty. When our appetites follow the arc of the sun, we bring balance to our plates. So part of what happened to me when I moved here was I began to get to know the area by going to the farmers' markets, by going out to farm stands, by talking to chefs, and by trying to understand why this area is so different from the one that I grew up in. And for me, that journey really made this place a home for me. And I think that's true of a lot of people that have moved here from other parts, and for people that have, you know, decided to intentionally get to know the area through its food. And so in the book, I talk a lot about the importance of the food shed, about understanding the regional systems that we can tap into that will make a real difference, I think, in a sustainable future. And a lot of that has to do with the work that people at the university are doing to extend the seasons with different green technologies that allow us to have fruits and vegetables that we've never had before. A lot of the work going into animal husbandry, where we're bringing back some of the heritage breeds that we haven't seen before, that are pastured, and then also some of the smaller processors that are trying to make this food shed more viable. That again is allowing us to access food from close by. So with that, what I think I'd like to do is to turn this back over to you and have you ask questions about what's going on, because it's always easier for me to, rather than sit here and go on and on, to find out what you're interested in knowing about the food chain and what kinds of questions you have about what's going on here. What are you guys cooking? Let's start with that. Do you shop at the markets? Do you belong to CSAs? Yeah. Yeah. Do you belong to a year-round CSA or?
My parents do a seasonal one.
Okay.
And so we go back and share it with them.
Yeah.
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 And he works in Beloit.
Oh, great.
Wisconsin.
Okay.
Monroe.
Yeah.
I work on a small organic farm.
Oh, do you really? Where?
In Monroe, Wisconsin.
Yeah, okay. So right kind of near, you're not too far from Milwaukee and Madison, that area?
Yeah. 40 minutes south of Madison.
Okay.
So
okay.
We go to Dane County Market.
Oh, nice.
We also go to the Chicago, the Lincoln Park.
Because Dane County is one of the most, it's probably, I think it's the biggest farmer's market in the country. Is that right? And they have some amazing things there. I mean, they've got, hickory nuts and hazelnuts and chestnuts and all kinds of meat and stuff. Like, you're really lucky. Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, and I grew up in a large organic farming community in Montevideo, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them supply, meat and CSA shares for different people down here.
That's wonderful. And I think what's really interesting to me is if you look at the history of our area, how our area's developed, we really are at the heart of what's going on with food right now in the country, because all of the big food corporations, got started here right after World War II, really, and the whole organic movement got started right after World War II. A lot of that took off in the Driftless area, where those farmers were among the first to adapt Rodale's method of organic farming. And right around that time, as they got going, people began to question the toxins in their food, Silent Spring and Adele Davis, and all these kind of cultural, icons began to say, wait a minute, And so a lot of the city folk got together and formed the early buying clubs and had a ready market with the organic farmers down in the Driftless area. So that gave rise to the co-ops. And we have more co-ops in this region than any other area in the country. We're just rich with co-ops. And I don't think people appreciate that. And those have been tremendously influential in really supporting those organic farmers and sustainable farmers, and a lot of the local farmers as well that aren't organic but are transitioning into organic. And the story, actually, the university has Atina Diffley's memoir coming out, is it next year, Todd? Yeah, in the spring, which tells the story of Gardens of Egan, which was the first and largest organic market grower in the state. And it also tells the story of their battles to prevent a pipeline from going across their land, which ultimately ended up changing the statute around, how organic farms are protected. So it's a really interesting story. But I think, I think one of the things that that I'm hoping comes through in the book is that it's not just about, it is about food, but it's about more than food, because those kinds of choices, I think, are very, they're very powerful. They're, and we all know that at one level, but when you begin to dig down, you realize that every time you make a decision around what you're going to eat, where you're going to buy it, where you're going to put your money, you really are making a decision that will influence somebody else. So, I think the CSA movement has been really interesting too. Not, you know, for a variety of reasons. One, because it's provided a lot of farmers another stream of income. Some CSA farmers are able to make a go of it just by having CSA farms. But most of them have two or three income streams coming in based on that activity. But CSA allows the farmers to capture some income early on. But for me as a cook, it's also really changed the way I cook, because by having those vegetables appear every week, I've had to respond to what's in the box. It's a much different mentality than marching into the grocery store and just buying what I want. All of a sudden, I'm faced with things that I might not be familiar, I might not have chosen, and I have to deal with it. And it just changes. It changes your relationship to food in a really interesting way. So I think those have been, I think they've been more, those have impacted people in ways I don't think they might have realized when they signed up for it. And then, of course, the farmers markets are booming right now. We have more farmers markets, I think, in our areas, just like the co-ops. We've got more farmers markets than per capita than any other area in the country. And they've provided a lot of the smaller growers with an outlet. But they've also helped seed a lot of the smaller organic businesses. And again, because food is still an area where there can be, where an entrepreneur can get started without enormous, you know, capital input. So you can begin a jam company. You can start a pickle company. You can begin a butter operation on a small scale without a huge capital investment and have a ready market at the farmer's market. And Cedar Summit Farms got started that way, for instance, and now they're one of the most successful dairies in the country. So there are a lot of success stories that come out of that as well. So the impact, the economic impact of buying local is enormous too. Yeah.
When you mention CSAs, it makes me wonder, have CSAs gotten involved at all with the school systems or vice versa, so that kids get exposed to some of those things that they might not otherwise see?
You know, that's a really good question. What's happened, the institutional side of local food is really interesting because it's so complicated, and it shouldn't be. But so much of the buying that institutional buyers have to, you know, so much of their buying decisions are based on menu planning and budgeting. And so they're looking for consistency, they're looking for price, and they're looking for ease, because in many cases there aren't any kitchens in those schools, so everything is cooked at a commissary and then delivered to the school. But what's happened because of the work of places like IATP, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is right in our own backyard, but which has had a tremendous force in the farm to school movement all across the country, is they're beginning to break some of that down and trying to deal with smaller school systems like Hopkins, for instance, and some of the smaller school systems in Wisconsin have been able to create relationships directly with farms where, yes, they will provide them all of their apples or all of their carrots, or, you know, it hasn't gotten as big as they don't have quite as much food as they local food as they'd like, but it's growing because they've been able now to connect the heads of the cafeterias of smaller school systems. Like the head of the cafeteria in the Hopkins school system now buys all of her carrots from Greg Reynolds' farm and all of the apples for all of Hopkins school systems from Greg Reynolds. So, but that was because Greg was willing to work with her and she was willing to dig around in her budget to figure out how to move money around within that budget to be able to do that. So you have to have both a farmer who's going to be flexible enough to do that and who can meet the demand, and a cafeteria, head of a cafeteria system, who's aggressive enough to want to try and make that work. Because it's not easy, but once they do it, they're seeing what a difference it makes, because they've, you know, they do these kind of trash inventories, and they realize that the kids are not throwing their potatoes away anymore, or they're actually eating their carrots. I mean, things like that.
And when you have successes, other people can see that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the other thing that's interesting, too, is because I interviewed a number of the cafeteria workers, and they loved it. Again, Hopkins is lucky because they didn't tear all their kitchens out. But all of a sudden, they feel like they're actually feeding their kids something good. And they're all nice people. I mean, they're not trying to feed junk to the kids. If they can cook good food, they want to. And they like kids. So, and they now feel a part of the school. They are empowered to know that what they're feeding the kids is good for them. And they can tell the kids that, and they can tell them stories about how they cooked it. And so they're engaging the kids in the food in a different way as well. So again, I think, you know, there are these unintended, really good consequences. We keep hearing about unintended consequences of bad stuff happening. You know, this is, I think, very hopeful because a lot of good stuff is coming out of it. Yeah. More questions? Yeah.
I was just wondering, what are the largest organic farms in Minnesota at the moment?
Well, Gardens of Eagan is really big. And Featherstone Farms down in the Rushford area, which is not far from Winona. It's Jack Hedin, and he's brilliant, and he's had several editorials in the New York Times about price supports, for instance, and he's very articulate, and he's a real force. Again, it's interesting because the Moses Conference, which is the Midwest Organic Conference, is the biggest conference of organic growers in the country. And I think it's because the organic farms here tend to be smaller than what you see on the West Coast. You know, we don't have, you know, an Earthbound Farms here, for instance. So there are a lot of farmers on smaller farms, but that conference has grown exponentially over the past 10 years. It started out with 150 people. There were almost 1,000 people that came last year. It's down in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's fascinating. There are a lot of people that come out of Washington to listen to what's going on. So I think, again, you know, our area suffers from that can anything good come out of Nazareth syndrome. I don't think we realize how much we really do have going on here in terms of food and what a force we can be, I think. More questions? Yeah.
I guess I have another question. Were you able to get any sense of the relationship between organic agriculture and traditional agriculture in the regions you were visiting, if there's what kind of, I don't know about conflict might not be the right word, but I know like where we are, we're like surrounded by farmers doing corn.
Conventional farm. Yeah, the conflict between conventional and organic farm. It's interesting, you know, it depends on what size farm you're talking about. In corn, for instance, in the commodity market, we were seeing more of the conventional farmers adapting organic methods because the price of fertilizer had gotten so high, and because they also saw that they could charge more for that commodity product, so that organic corn and organic soybeans got more on the market. What's happened, unfortunately, is now that there's consumer resistance to that because, you know, food's gotten expensive, some of them are beginning to convert back. So for the first time in about 5 years, we've seen a decline in transition from conventional to organic. And transitioning to organic is not easy. It's a 3-year process. It's expensive because you can't charge the price of organic for a transitional crop. So the farmer is taking a real hit during that transitional period, especially if they're selling a commodity crop. So there was enough incentive for a while for people to transition, and I'm surprised that they're willing to go back. But I guess because, you know, the times are so tight, they are. The history, you know, what's really interesting is we had an opportunity back in the late 60s, early 70s for a lot of the large farmers to become organic. Rodale was doing really well in introducing smaller machinery and some of the organic fertilizers and inputs that weren't toxic to these farmers, because by that time, by the 70s, a lot of the corn farmers, especially corn and soy farmers, were beginning to see how degraded their land was becoming because of the chemicals they were using. And they were also realizing that they were getting sick, their kids were getting sick, there weren't any birds on the property anymore. They didn't like what was going on. And so they began to sort of dig around and respond to Rodale's push to supply a lot of these, organic fertilizers and enhancers. And those things were sold by salesmen who would hold conventions or hold dinner meetings and stuff in these small towns and start to talk about what they were doing. And so they started to get, you know, that's when you had the North Dakota Soil Association, and that's when you had the Minnesota Soil Association, which eventually became MOSAS, which is, you know, Midwest Organic Sustainable Agriculture, whatever it is. That's when all those groups got started. Okay. Around the same time, and now his name slips me, it was the Secretary of Agriculture who was with Ronald Reagan, and I can't remember his name, but he sponsored us, and this was Reagan's, he sponsored a study to see whether or not organic farming was as productive for big crops as was conventional farming, and they found out that it was. And they published a report that was distributed. They had 20,000 copies of this report, and they had some meetings, and they sent it out to a number of the extension people who began distributing this. Well, within 2 years, the ag companies responded to that, and the lobbyists put enough pressure on it that they did not go back to press, and the report kind of disappeared, and the word organic was struck from any USDA material after 1980. And then, again, this is all in my notes, another researcher went back through and wrote a huge report that finally got some traction in Congress called Looking for the O Word, which dug all of this back up and spoke to the viability of organic methods. But we did have that opportunity, that small window of opportunity back in the 70s, between the 70s and 80s, to really begin to transition. And so there is scientific documentation. In fact, the New York Times did a front page story on it, saying that, you know, they are equally productive in terms of large scale farming. You know, and now people are trying to bring some of that back. But again, money's short. You know, and the system is pretty embedded, but there are people like Paul Roberts and some of the other economists that are looking at our food system and looking at soil fertility and trying to figure out, you know, how to address a lot of the environmental and economic issues we're seeing happening right now with the food system, and saying, okay, it is possible to farm this way and to farm productively. There is proof around that. So it's interesting. So to answer your question, I think it depends on where you are. And I think, you know, I know Jim Riddle, who is with the University of Minnesota Extension Service, has been very active in helping farmers transition into organic. I think because farmers are, you know, they're and I mean this in a positive way, they're typically really independent and really self-reliant. And so it's a matter of, it truly is a relationship business, and it's a matter of people, you know, like Jim Riddle and other extension people going out with the information and sort of showing them how it works. And I think there has been a huge effort to do that. Because, you know, the other thing is, in talking to the people that I've met as I've traveled around this area, we really should not be vilifying conventional farmers. They all really care about what they're doing, and a lot of them are just trapped by the economics of it. And they didn't go into it blindly. They just thought they were doing the right thing. So, Yeah.
What are some of the most unusual, interesting things that are being grown and packaged for sale, like wonderful sunflower oil?
Yeah, sunflower oil is really interesting. It's a beautiful oil. And there are two companies now. I'm going to get the name wrong. It's Smud, I think. S-M-U-D-E. And there's another one called Driftless. And they're pressing organic sunflower seeds into oil. It's a gorgeous golden oil. Unlike olive oil, it doesn't burn when you cook using high temperatures. And yet it has a really nice, rich, nutty flavor. And sunflowers grow like mad. And you can find it at all of the co-ops and a lot of the specialty food stores. So we're seeing those kinds of crops. We're seeing work with nuts, which are wonderful addition to organic farms because they're perennials and they capture water. And, you know, you don't have to till them in. They're great for animals. And they also are a nice protein source. And then chestnuts, we're seeing the American chestnut, actually. It's a hybrid chestnut, Americanoid chestnut is coming back. There are a lot of, what else? Wheat, we're seeing a lot of the ancient strains of wheat. Farro is a very nutritious wheat. It looks like a wheat berry, but it cooks in about 20 minutes like pasta, or 15 minutes like pasta. And it's really good. It sort of looks like a brown barley. So we're starting to see that come back. Some of the heirloom varieties of corn up on the White Earth Reservation, they're growing a hominy corn that's good. You can use it as a replacement for bean. And we're seeing a lot of the shell beans coming back too, cranberry beans. And so the growers are growing out, you know, the black beans and cranberry beans and some of the white beans and soybeans, of course, that are a nice source of protein too. So we're seeing more variety in the crops. And then with some of the extensions, season extensions, both the greenhouse and the hoop house technologies, they're able to have tomatoes as late as, you know, into December in some cases, depending on the weather. So that's helped a lot as well. So, yeah, and that's all because of the university work. The other thing is they're hybridizing some of the crops so that we may see kiwis before too long. I've seen some research around kiwis, which would be really fun. Nice source of vitamin C. Yeah, so it's interesting. There's, again, another university scholar, but he's also a CSA farmer up in Finland, Minnesota, which, you know, looks like it's, I mean, you go up there and there's really nothing up there, right? I mean, the land is beautiful, but there, you wonder, you know, you can't see any, I mean, there's it doesn't look like there are any houses. I mean, but he did a study that showed, given the demographics of the area, the soil fertility, the way the weather was changing, and the technology around raising tilapia, his work trying to get hazelnuts going, for instance, that area could be completely, that food chain could feed itself. And he's got, you know, maps and stuff that show how that can be done. So it's interesting. So I don't know. I think it's really hopeful. With all the doom and gloom, it's fun to talk about food, right? Yeah.
I guess I was wondering what sort of efforts are going on in the cities and in Minnesota to get more food into low-income communities.
Yeah, food justice is huge. And actually, you know, I give R.T. Ryback a lot of credit because they did start that Homegrown Minneapolis, which... we're going to see more coming out of Homegrown Minneapolis in the next couple of years, I think. They're trying to break down a lot of the barriers. And, you know, there are a lot of issues that they're trying to address. One of the regulations around food, you know, I can't buy tomatoes from you, for instance. Okay, so they're trying to make it possible for some of these small food companies to be able to sell, you know, within their neighborhoods. They're also trying to incent some of the food distributors to go into 7-Elevens, for instance, to deliver apples. I mean, it sounds like a small thing, but one of the biggest problems is that there's no access to good food, right? So they're trying to figure out how to almost require that those trucks deliver produce to 7-Elevens and some of the you know, whatever the convenience stores are in those lower income areas. They're also incenting a lot of the farmers markets. And we've seen on those neighborhood corners, especially in North Minneapolis, a number of small farmers markets in church parking lots and in community centers. They launched a series of cooking classes in some of the community centers to make it more, to just, again, kind of educate people. Because one of the problems is that, nobody knows how to cook. And that's sort of been one of the biggest problems in trying to address this whole food justice thing, is that the perception is I don't have time and I don't have the money to buy the ingredients. So the health department was also given the charter by the city to start to figure out how to address that, and they're actually having some success. The YMCA's have a number of teen classes and cooking classes and health ed classes that are working on that as well. And in many cases, it's, you know, if you can get to it's too hard to get to the parents. If you can get to the teenagers and convince them that it's a good thing to do. And in a lot of those families, it's the teenagers that are, they're the cooks anyway, and they're the ones that are buying the food. Because both parents are working full time, lots, you know, and they're working a lot. They've found that they've had more impact that way. Then also some of the youth gardening programs, like Youth Farm and Market Project, and the Design Center, have had an impact too. Those are after school programs and summer programs for kids that are 9 to 13, and those kids raise the food in these community gardens. They cook lunch every day during the summer. And in many cases, those kids report that they also then cook the same thing at night. So they're feeding their families that way. So again, it's hopeful. I mean, it's hard. Will Allen, are you familiar with him? Yeah, Growing Power, which is a group out of Milwaukee, which is a farm in the city, has an outreach project with Little Earth Native American community, High Rise. And they're trying to get a vermiculture thing going and a community farm going up there too. So there's work being done that we don't see, I think, you know, which is interesting too, because I think this whole notion that local foods are too expensive, organic food is too expensive, is really, again, I first of all, it's not true. You know, if you go to the co-op and you buy bulk, you know, and you shop wisely, it really, it's not that much more expensive, and the same thing is true with the farmers markets. So, if you talk to some of the more radical writers, they'll say, you know, that's just, we're seeing pushback from the corporations. But I don't want to get into that. So. Well, great. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out, and I'm sorry I was late. So, oh, good. Okay, great. Great, great, great. Yeah, there are lots of, I don't know, what are you going to make for dinner tonight? Oh, good, excellent. I've got lots of ideas. Yeah. Oh, you're nice to ask. I'm working on one right now about the farmers markets, actually. And the focus is the St. Paul Farmers Market, because that is the oldest farmers market in the country. And most people don't realize that. It's the oldest retail farmers market. I should qualify that. The oldest retail farmers market. It has a wonderful history. It has always sold produce directly to homes. You know, I mean, people are always bashing the Minneapolis farmers market, which I'm quite fond of, but that has a much different history. That's always been a trucker's market, and that's always sold to retail outlets, whereas the St. Paul farmers market is always sold directly to consumers. And it's had three locations, and right now it was one of the first markets in the country to be farmer run, and to demand that everything come from within a 50-mile radius. So it has this great history of being very local and being farmer-run. So it's a interesting market. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's never had a book written about it?
No, it hasn't. It's, you know, they do have a cookbook, but it doesn't give much of the history of it. It doesn't talk much about its legacy or its place in the community. I think the story is interesting because that farmers market especially grew out of not only the need of city people who didn't have, you know, enough in their garden to feed themselves, but immigrants bringing the foods from their homeland, planting it, having them grow here and growing too much, and first selling to their neighbors and then realizing, you know, they had even way too much zucchini, for instance. So they would take it down to the market and sell it that way. And so that's where a lot of the Italian foods became introduced to this area, where the Hmong foods became introduced, Vietnamese foods, some of the West African foods, all sort of entered our mainstream culture via the market. So it's really been a sort of a cross-pollinating force. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you know, the Italian grower trading tomatoes with a Hmong grower, you know, for peppers. And so then seeing, you know, this sort of hybrid, really fun sort of hip hop kind of thing going on. So, well, thank you. Thanks. All right. Eat well. Buy lots of books. So thanks. All right.